Okay, that looks green. Thanks, Udo, for the kind introduction. It's actually good to know. I didn't know that you were involved in all of this. Yes, this is basically part of the story where this all comes from. My name is Markus Haenel, and as Udo said, I'm with KernConcept. I was fighting a bit with myself what I'm going to talk here about, because people said, oh, L4IE, we haven't heard so long about it, and make a talk, tell us what's new. And there's a lot of new things. But still, since I can't tell everything because I don't know everything, I try to limit myself to the stuff I work on a daily basis. And part of that is the safety and security. And I'm trying to touch on some other points that are new in L4IE land as well. Stuff was new. There have been a lot of new developments since then. I'm trying to pick some that might be of interest to everyone. So we have now RISC-V support in L4IE. I think that was released last year or the year before, including the hypervisor extensions. There is also now, I think, Adam, there's hardware, right, recently. So finally, you can also use it. We've had it before, but only with the emulation stuff. But now you can also use it. We have the micro hypervisor, which actually is bringing this whole thing that you know as L4IE, as the microkernel, with all of the abstractions, with all of the features, to the Cortex-R world. So it's not the Cortex-Ms that Eduard just talked about, but it's the Cortex-Rs that face basically the same problem. They don't have an MMU, they have an MPU, and we ported this to the system. We did quite a lot of work on extending the WordIO support in our system. So UVMM is our virtual machine monitor, and we have a lot of work going into this because this is one of the main things that is a selling point for a microkernel-based hypervisor and operating system, that you have these abstract interfaces that you can tell your users, well, it doesn't matter what your hardware is. You have your system developed against the WordIO interface, and everything's nice. You switch the hardware, you switch the hardware vendor, it all stays the same for you, wherever that's possible. So one of the things we recently internally demoed is that we have a WordIO GPU demo running where you have two instances, for example, an Android and a Linux, running in parallel and sharing the GPU, which is a really nice demo when you can see L4IE showing an Android and a Linux, and one of them runs Angry Birds, which is always the demo you do, right? The other news is that we are on quite a few new system platforms. It doesn't really matter to name them all. There's an IMX95, there's the Aircars from Renesas, there's the NXP hardware. All of this kind of ties into this automotive story, right? Because that's one of our major customers as a company. But L4IE is also, since last year, or even since 2 years ago, we run on ARM system-ready platforms. So if you have something like a Graviton, if you have an ARM Neoverse, like an Adlink system, you can just boot it and it runs. It's an ARM 64 UEFI platform, and we have support for this now, which is pretty amazing, I think. When it comes to the other parts, it's all about how can we make others believe us that our system is safe and secure, right? It's not just about building a safe and secure system. In security certified systems, for a long time, the first product that was actually certified by a customer of ours with L4IE was certified to Verschlusssache, not nur für den Dienstgebrauch, so it's the lowest ranking in German confidentiality in 2013. So we worked with a customer to get this system certified. This continued in 2017 with having a Geheim. This is the second level. So it's kind of like secret, but you're not allowed to translate it. It's Geheim. So we got this certification in 2017, or better, a customer product got this. And the story was always about this. You get a certification for an appliance. So you build a box, you put it somewhere, and this gets a certification, and that's it. And if you build a new box, you need a new certification. And since we had a lot of inquiries into getting this done, in 2024, we finalized something namely that we got the operating system on its own accredited to be Geheim certified. Oh, it's called Geheim accredited. And this means that it's the only operating system out there, and it's open source, that you can actually use in a Geheim context for the German government, for example. The other thing is that last year we got these two certifications. The nice thing is with the ASIL certification, this is the automotive safety certification, so it's It's called ASIL-B because it's an intermediate certification, which makes sense for the types of systems this is to be used on. You kind of get an ASIL-2 certification for free, which is the industrial safety certification. And as I said, the EL4 Plus certification is imminent. We're still waiting for the final okay, but all the documents have been handed in, and barring any further requests, we should get it soon. So now this is kind of has been my day-to-day business in the last 5 years. And then they go ahead and tell you, you need to test this. And you tell them, but it's unreachable on this platform. And this is really hard to get into the mindset of the people that you have generic software that has actually generic code that sometimes doesn't matter on a specific platform. And we did all of this. We certified this together with Electrobit, who did a huge sponsoring job on this and worked together with us as a safety element out of context, which means you can use L4RE, which from our component point of view is the kernel itself and the root pager. You can use them in a safety context, and then you can build your safety system on top of it. There we go again. Let's do it like that. And the nice thing is that all of this flew back into the open source release. So we did a lot of processes looking into interfaces. Are they well defined? Do they have unexpected behavior? Not necessarily bugs, but stuff where the developer might imagine that something behaves differently than it does in reality. And actually we found a few of those instances where he said, yeah, it's not a bug, doesn't break security, doesn't break safety, but it's non-obvious. And if you don't know about this, you might actually write an application that in the end makes wrong assumptions about the system behavior and thus cannot be safely used. So these are things that really just brought forward, right? It's a lot of documents, it's a lot of paper, but you also gain a lot from it. Besides all of these document stuff, you have also this nice topic, static analyses and compiler warnings. So there are a few standards, and actually the ISO standard doesn't prescribe what you have to do. It just says you need to have some Zane rule work of static analyzers and of checkers that you employ to make sure that this is all Zane. The standard way to do is to use a standard rule set. Back when we started the project, the industry standard rule sets were things like MISRA C++ 2008 or the AUTOSAR rules. They have a large set of rules, and a lot of them don't make a lot of sense for an operating system. It's really hard because they tell you things to not do, which from a user land perspective is totally Zane. You shouldn't do this. Developed and change the cost of changing a rule would be higher than keeping the code as it is. For example, when somebody tells you to change all of your types in your code and all of the comparisons or whatever, the risk that you introduce errors is just so much huger than the gain that you get from this that you would usually not do this. So you would follow an approach where you say, okay, for new code, we try to adhere to this. For existing code, we keep it as is. And the certification agencies usually accept this if it's well reasoned, right? Because we tried for some of the MISRA rules to implement them, and if you just go through it and do a blanket like seek and replace of stuff that MISRA thinks it's not okay, you will introduce bugs. We had cases like this. We have all of this warning free. I think for most open source projects, or for many of them, this is actually comes as a given, right? Usually people don't write code that has warnings. Neither do we. We enable all of the standard warnings and a bit more. Some of these are actually also basically just showing stuff that MISRA implements, right? Things that the compiler can check easily. Nice anecdotes about static analyzers can be found a lot, because there are a large number of solutions on the market, and they are usually quite good for the demo cases. The thing is that many of those are tailored towards small embedded projects, right, where you have 20 C files and compile them together into one single binary, and then you have this, and that's it. It gets challenging when you want to check a whole operating system, where you have libraries that are shared between components, where you have to justify errors in the checker and need to tell, this is wrong. And now you need to tell it for every program that uses this library, because the tool actually doesn't support you with this. There's a lot of this stuff. We had a lot of cases where we actually found in testing or in other cases, things where we thought, this should have been found by a static analyzer, a null pointer check that was missing. And the static analyzer could have told us, and it actually didn't turn out anything right. So our experience is static analyzers can be useful to find issues, and we did find a few. If we compare this to the incredible amount of whitelist entries we had to do, where we had to tell the analyzer, no, this is actually correct code, this is fine, the effort would have been better spent in more testing or reviewing the code, but that's the way it is. There are also rules that are really hard to implement in general that don't make a lot of sense, and sometimes the static analyzers actually don't implement them correctly. So we just got this sometimes as a statement, yes, it's broken. We quality managed and safety applications next to each other, and for the safety components, you needed a lot more. So we also needed to specify requirements. So it's not enough to say you have these interfaces and the code implements the interfaces. You need to be traceable. What part of the code implements what part of your system for what reason? And especially this what reason is reflected in the requirements. So you have things like, I need to be able to share memory between applications or to high level requirements. I need to be able to communicate between applications. So you break that down. I need an IPC gate in our system design. And then you break that down. You need to be able to bind to the IPC gate. You need to be able to call it and so on. And then you break that down again. So this is quite a lot. The high level stuff was about 100 requirements. The lower level ones, 525. All of this is linked to the source code. All of it is linked to tests. So each requirement needs a test. And as you can see in the last bullet point, we wrote about 100 tests. So this is really the code, 100 code blocks that are tests. We use gtest as a framework. And this boils down to about 7,000 test instances that we run every time we change anything in the system to make sure that it still works. It's about 130,000 lines of test code in total. About half of these tests are kernel unit tests. So they really need to test the kernel internally. The reason for this basically comes up on the next slide. And this is kind of a hard requirement. We always tried if we can avoid it. We can't. Turns out you need coverage. And while the ISO standard doesn't say you need 100% coverage, the certifier says, well, if you don't have 100, you need to give a good reason why the remaining part is not violating your safety guarantees. And this basically means you need 100 plus whitelists. And whitelists need to be very sparsely used, because otherwise people won't believe you that this is really, really safe. So all of these tests and all of these requirements were done to get the kernel to 100% code coverage on the platform that was the target for the customers. This was the S32G in this case, and we actually got it done. And there's a lot of interesting anecdotes to be told about this as well. Coverage is hard. We try to use open. We have some very smart people in the company that actually made use of this, so you can extract all of this information in the binary, and you can then get information such as that this part, yes, it's in the coverage report, and GCC would have also given you this, but LVM also tells you that this is no longer in the final binary, and this makes it believable that we don't need to cover it. We also extended this tooling and the HTML generation with our own whitelisting, because that's the thing I mentioned before, right? You need to rationalize everything that you don't cover. So, for example, if we have this generic IRQ manager implementation and we say, okay, on this platform, you always have an IRQ chip, right? Then it doesn't make sense to have this check, so we made a whitelist entry. In total, that was 314 whitelist entries, which I think for a total of 13,000 lines of code, it's quite okay, right? It's blocks. It could be large blocks, but it usually isn't, right? It's usually 3 lines, 4 lines, 5 lines. And we needed to optimize the code for the generation for this, or adapt it. The nice thing is that our customer actually uses this. So we now have a safe hypervisor, and they use this to make Linux safe. Because my argument would be, if you need to do this for Linux, you might get it done if you throw enough people at it. But unless you get the Linux developers to follow a process that keeps this in sync, you will be lost. It moves too fast. You cannot follow up with all of these artifacts. You need some other way to ensure the safety of a Linux application. And our customers, or Electrobit, actually uses this to build something called Safe Linux, or EB Corpus Linux for Safety, it's called. They basically use the hypervisor that's safety certified and our virtual machine monitor and introspect the Linux to make sure that if there's any safety violation in a Linux safety application happening, that you can trigger a handler that can actually handle this problem. And for ASLB, that's actually enough. So you get all of the benefits of having safety into Linux by just certifying the hypervisor, which is a nice thing. And in principle, all of this anyone could do using just the system that's out there on GitHub. Okay, I'm nearly over time already. So the micro hypervisor thing, I have two left. I promised to tell a bit of about this. It's basically the thing Eduard said. We ported this to the Cortex-R platform. Basically means no MMUs. We use MPUs to protect applications. We remove some because these platforms have very stringent memory requirements. So we did a lot of work in optimizing this whole system. And all of this makes this very flexible. So let's skip this. You can look at the slides later. What's on the horizon? Usability is one of the main topics. We now have native FRE cross tool chains. They have been they are being worked on and will be published soon, which means you can just have a cross compiler that just like you would call the GCC minus MingGV, you can have an L4RE. And we have a Rust cross compiler that's out now. We have ADA support on the horizon, etc. The challenges are keeping the certification alive, and even though we have contributors that are not interested in safety. And if anybody has good ideas how this can be done, we are currently working on our own internal processes, but we would value any feedback from the community that might want to contribute to a system, how they see this. We obviously don't want developers to write requirements and documentation and tests to the last degree for every aspect they contribute. And that's it for now. Sorry.
Thanks, Markus. The